Okay, what I'm going to talk about, I should start.
Yes. Okay, yes. It's
has to do with non-relativistic quantum field theory. So, namely, I want to say a few words about a massless Nelson model, which is a very simple model of a particle interacting with a field caused by many massless particles. In addition, I'll have a few words to say about the so-called non-relativistic quantum electrodynamics. But I'm going to take, I'm going to do something really simple. So, more complicated than one particle, one massive non-relativistic particle in the field in the electromagnetic field or the field of a scalar field caused by massless particles. Before I say anything, let me say that this is joint work with David Hassler, who's a postdoc at Virginia right now, University of Virginia. Let me also just mention a few. There's a huge amount of work that's been done by this, and we are really newcomers to this field. But let me mention a few of the papers that are relevant to what we're doing. So, there's something that got me thinking about these things was when I was a student in physics and learning about quantum electrodynamics. The most fascinating part of that was how to deal with photons and the fact that the photons were treated in an ad hoc fashion. Just, you know, you wrote some Feynman diagrams, and sometimes things were infinite, so you had to sum over infinitely many photons, and nobody had even took into account the Coulomb phase, as is done in non-relativistic scattering. So I really got fascinated by that, but I really didn't do anything about it until really now, when we've done a little work. But I did see a paper by Fadeyev and Kulish, which was really interesting. And in this paper, by totally ad hoc methods, they came up with some way of understanding what a one electron state would look like asymptotically. So this one electron state was really not just one electron, but it was an electron surrounded by many soft photons, an infinite number of soft photons. Nothing, to my knowledge, really rigorous has been done in quantum electrodynamics about this because, well, quantum electrodynamics, you know, has a hard time being constructed anyway, so. And people usually worry about ultraviolet divergences before they worry about the infrared. Jörg Fröhlich got interested in this and in 1974 wrote some papers about basically about the model I'm going to talk about. One thing he did that's relevant to what we were doing is that he put some sort of infrared cutoff in his model. So this was a model of a non-relativistic particle, just one particle, one massive particle, non-relativistic, just minus Laplacian is the kinetic energy, coupled to a scalar field of massless particles. And he put some sort of infrared cutoff and try to take a limit to see what happened. And the model he looked at was translation invariant. So he looked at the fibers of he wrote as the Hamiltonian is a direct integral and looked at the fibers was able to show that there was a ground state for it with an infrared cutoff which left the Hilbert space when the cutoff was taken away. That's one of the things he did that's relevant for us. Well, he's certainly come back to the problem in some work with Bach and Siegel. So they've done an awful lot of work. So I have a reference to a 2000 paper, but there's a large number of... it's before that. So I don't actually know. There's a bunch of papers here, and they even continue to this day. they're interested in quantum electrodynamics with, of atoms and non-relativistic quantum electrodynamics of atoms and molecules, and they're looking at ground states, resonances, things like that. Griesemer, Leib, and Loss have also gotten into the picture. And I actually have, this is that 2000 reference, where they do some improvements of Bach, Frehley, Siegel. A graduate student of Frehley, Thomas Chen, has some unpublished work, which I guess everybody quotes, where he was able to look at the ground state energy as a function of the total momentum in a translationally invariant model. And at least for small coupling constant and small momentum, total momentum show that it was C2 and had some sort of properties that are relevant for us. Some other work that I'll be mentioning is work by Lorenci. Minlos Spohn, where they look at a model of, let's say, let's call it an electron, but it's spinless, let's call these massless particles photons, but it's just a scalar field. So they look at that, but they, in addition, add some sort of confining, a very special class of confining potentials, thinking maybe there should be a ground state, and they find that there isn't. The paper is somewhat complicated. Then there's some work of, I think I may be leaving out one of the authors. Graber and Guillot, who do the same thing as Griesemer, Leib, Loss, and Bach, Frehley, Siegel, but they look in the center of mass frame. So the atoms and molecules can move around. so in other words, the nuclei are not infinitely massive, and they're looking to see whether there are bound states in the center of mass frame. And they show, at least in certain cases, that there are. And other cases, they don't seem to be able to, and it's kind of interesting. I'll have some comment maybe to make about that. Maybe it's relevant, maybe not. Okay, so let me get down to explain the actual models of the Hamiltonians, the actual operators. So this is what I'm going to call a massless Nelson model. So here's there's a Hilbert space, which is L2 of R3, tensor the Fock space of a massless particle, so these are a direct sum of n particle subspaces, and each n-particle subspace consists of totally symmetric wave functions of the momentum variables, let's say, in L2 of R3n, where n is the number of particles. And the Hamiltonian can be thought of this way, minus Laplacian x tends to 1. So this x in L2 of R3, this 1 is for the Fock space. Plus we have the energy of the free, I'm going to call them photons even though they're not, so F stands for field, let's say. And so these, the electrons here don't interact with the photons, but now you add a scalar field. I'll put a row here to explain in a second. So this x is the position of the electron. The electron. I'm calling it an electron, but it really, of course, isn't. So let me explain. If we look at the let's say, call it F in the Fock space. Then if I look at HF, whoops, I shouldn't call this F, let's call it G. I look at the n particle component of this as a function of K1, Kn. This is just the sum of the energies, which are just the momenta. The field sub rho of x, I'll just write as some strange looking factor over here, square root of twice the energy. Then we have a creation operator of a photon of momentum k. Now let's put here a rho of k. So this is the field. This rho is an ultraviolet cutoff. So you can think of rho as just, really it should somehow be just 1 for all k, but we cut it off at high momentum so that this makes sense. A and A star are creation operators. But let me just tell you what, just for definiteness, let me just say what A of k does. If I have this is what the creation, the annihilation operator, that's how it acts, and the A star of K is its adjoint. This is sort of formal because you must smear A star of K and A of K with an L2 function for it to actually make sense. Nelson actually wasn't interested in the case where it was massless. So instead of this absolute K over here, he would have something that was non-zero at k equals 0, or was always non-zero. It would have been, let's say, the square root of k squared plus m squared instead of the square root of absolute k. And he was interested in the ultraviolet behavior, and he was able to do something to take rho to 1. In fact, he actually did this for a much more complicated model where he had many electrons, let's say, call them electrons, and each one interacted with the field. Okay. Any questions about the setup?
How many arguments does the
variable, I'm sorry?
How many variables does the function gn plus 1 has?
N plus 1 times 3.
You can see, right, okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. 3 n plus 1.
I just missed the first k for some reason. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, and let me just say that these are sort of canonical commutation relations. Delta is a three-dimensional delta function. Let me just say a couple of words about why phi has this form. Basically, once you put the time in, you want this thing, if the rho was not there, if it was just 1, you'd want it to satisfy the wave equation. If there was a free Hamiltonian for photons, you'd want it to satisfy the wave equation. So that's why that square root of 2k there. And in addition, you'd like the time derivative of phi, let's call that pi and phi, to satisfy canonical commutation relations. So these two things give you something like that, where the A star and A satisfy this relation. But they don't tell you that it's acting on the Fock space, and one just does that because that's the way we think things should be. So maybe that's wrong for massless particles. But I'm going to stick with that for now. Yeah?
I have a stupid question. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is the creation operator. You said it is annihilation, not creation. What is it?
This is the annihilation operator.
And it raises
the number of particles. It seems to raise the number of particles.
Well, it doesn't raise the number of particles. I'm looking at the...
How does it annihilate?
Yeah. Notice that if G was a one-particle wave function, I'd need there to be two particles.
G as N plus one variable and A of K, G as N.
In other words, you have to...
Yes.
This takes from the state above, right? The n-particle component comes from above. Okay.
All right. Function of n plus one variable and
I have already made my excuses. I'm sorry.
Okay, I mean, anyway, so there's a vacuum state and A of K omega. Okay? All right, so what do I want to say about these things? There's also a concept of the total momentum, not only the total energy of the flow. So let's call it P sub F, G, and K1. And this is just equal to K1 plus Kn, Gn, K1, Kn. So that's the total momentum of all the photons. Okay. Now, this Hamiltonian commutes with... okay, so there's P, which is minus I gradient x, and then there's P total, which is P plus PF. And I'm going to leave out the tensor products from now on. So this is the total momentum. And if you look, you can see that H commutes with the total momentum. In other words, the Hamiltonian is invariant under translations. So you should be able to find a direct integral representation for this Hamiltonian over the total momentum. So to do that, First notice that if I look at edix.pf, and I look at not pf, yeah, pf, p, e to the minus ix.pf. So what is this? This is equal to p minus pf. So if I look at what happens to the total momentum under this transformation, the total momentum involves the sum of the two of these guys. PF commutes with that unitary operator. So this is just P. So now in the new representation where this e to the I x dot PF takes our Hilbert space into itself, the total momentum is actually the electron momentum. So I could write H. So if I look at e to the I x dot pf H e to the minus I x dot pf, I get, of course, something unitary equivalent to H. And what is that? Well, what you have here is P minus, because of this, minus pf squared. One has just this HF. I'm leaving out the tensor products. And actually, if you look what happens here, you just get phi rho of 0. So the X is completely gone. So one finds that H is unitary equivalent to a direct integral over R3 of some h of xi, d3 xi, where h of xi just comes by doing a Fourier transform and changing this p into just xi. So h of xi here is just equal to xi minus pf squared plus hf plus phi rho of 0. Let me say what the Hilbert space is. So the Hilbert space is just, you can think of it as, so it's L2 of R3 tensor the Fock space, and it's unitary equivalent to just thinking of this as the direct integral of Fock spaces. You know, we think of fixing the momentum here. We think of these as momentum space wave functions and just fix the momentum at C. And then you just have a Fock space. Okay? So one question here is, does H of C have a ground state? So, I mean, it's bounded. It turns out it's self-adjoint and bounded below. If I look at E of C equal the infima of the spectrum of H of xi. The question is this an eigenvalue? You might want it to be an eigenvalue in the sense that there should be a concept of addressed one electron state, you know, some electron surrounded by a certain cloud of photons. But here's a theorem that says that for almost every C, Qc, is not an eigenvalue. Now, maybe I can integrate a proof later, but what Frölich proves is that when you take the infrared cutoff away, the eigenstate goes out of the Hilbert space. It doesn't prove that there isn't an eigenstate there when the infrared cutoff is gone. you might ask what about the rest of the spectrum of H of C, and what do we know about it? In fact, what is the spectrum? What is the spectrum of, this is something. I mean, you might just think it's obvious that the spectrum is just from E of C, it's a half line starting at E of C, and that's true. So. But as far as I'm concerned, the proof isn't that trivial, actually. So maybe there are gaps in the spectrum. How do we know? You might think you could just always add a soft photon. Soft means, you know, very low energy, and get into the gap, but that doesn't work. So at least we haven't been able to make it work.
Sorry, it's again a naive question, but for the initial problem, you are interested to the infimum over xi of E of xi, or?
So E of xi is the infimum.
Yes, but for fixed psi.
Fixed psi.
For the initial problem, you are interested in the infimum over xi of E of xi, or you don't think at this point, or?
No, that's not the, that's not what I was interested in. I was thinking that, the electron, of course, moves with some momentum, because momentum is conserved here, so we can talk about the momentum of the total system. And for each momentum, maybe there's a ground state.
Okay, you don't... The most interesting at the end is not to look at the infimum of xi of E of xi. It's not the problem.
Well, you mean to say whether there's a ground state at that...
Yes, for
it can't be, right? Because
not necessarily.
No, it can't be because of the translation invariance. Because it can be, so it would be an infinite number of orthogonal,
But you are not more interested in at the bottom of the the spectrum, and
but
psi, which
I wasn't interested.
Okay,
but maybe it's zero. If it's zero, then.
If what is zero?
If the minimum is achieved with xi equals zero, then?
Yes. Then?
Then your translation invariant argument still works?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's interesting to other people, but we weren't interested. Okay? Now there are other results which I'm not going to say anything about the nature of the spectrum, but for various values of the coupling constant, so the coupling constant here you could think of as rho, and for small xi, then Bach, Frölich, and Siegel have some results about the nature of the spectrum. One can easily show that it's absolutely continuous from some point on, from some high energy on. But the interesting thing is, what about low energies? And they have results away from zero. Away from, not zero, but away from the minimum energy. The ground state energy. So, here's another result. And suppose... minus Laplacian x plus g of x is essentially self-adjoint on C0 infinity of R3 and bounded below. So then you can ask for just taking this, where is it? So there's no H listed here. Maybe it's... No, okay. So let's take the Hamiltonian equal to minus Laplacian x plus v of x plus hf plus phi sub rho of x. Now it's no longer a v could, v is not a constant, it's not translation invariant any longer. You can ask, suppose v looks like this, does there exist a ground state? This is the total Hamiltonian now. E of C inf, let's say E sub V inf sigma H sub V. Whoops, there's no C here. Is not an eigenvalue. This is a pretty strange result, and I should mention that this is partly some work of Lorenzi, Minlos, and Spohn. Where they considered a particular confining potential that grows in a certain way at infinity. This proof, though, however, is actually... they do other work as well, but they do most of it in path space and some in, using the usual path space for in quantum field theory. we have a simple proof of this that works for more potentials. So let me now look at the Pauli-Fiertz model, non-relativistic QED. Where H is in our simple minded model with no, just one electron and no interactions between, well, there's only an interaction between the electric field and, or the electromagnetic field and the electron, but no electron-electron interactions because there's only one electron. So you have, this time I'm neglecting the interaction of the magnetic field with the electron. It should be, there should be another term here, but it's not important. In fact, we could do it with that term. But here, P is again, minus I gradient of x. And A rho is a sort of complicated vector potential at the position of the electron. So it looks something like similar to the one before, but there's some complicating aspects because of spin. Not very complicated, but okay, so this operator creates a photon of polarization lambda and momentum k, and one has these usual commutation relations, just another variable to have around. And I think everything else is pretty well defined. This operator acts on now the Fock space is actually instead of just the momentum variable, you have the polarization variable plus or minus one, and it's symmetric. The wave functions are symmetric in all variables. I mean, no. In each of the n variables in the n particle sector. so we have okay. So again, let me do some more erasing. Again, this model is translation invariant, and so one. Well, one sees that H is unitary equivalent to direct integral again over momentum of some H of C, where H of C again is very similar. To the well, there's a similar difference, p minus pf minus a rho. So this is what it looks like. So this is acting just in the Fock space. So the Hilbert space again is direct integral. Fock spaces. So we have a result in this case, and that is that so let's let E of C again be the infimum of the spectrum. Then E of its argument is differentiable almost everywhere. Suppose C is such that the gradient of E of C exists and is non-zero. Then E of C is not an eigenvalue. So actually, Chen proves in his unpublished work that E of Xi is actually Xi2 for small Xi and for, you can think of rho as being a coupling constant here. Or you can put a coupling constant in front of rho, let's put it that way. Of course, we still want rho to be basically one near the origin. So that there is really, the infrared problem is treated properly. The ultraviolet problem is not, but I'm not just interested in that for the time being. so again, I should say that the kind of work. So what Chen does is he again cuts, makes an infrared cutoff and lets that go to zero. He doesn't even have a full result that says that the function, the state does not, that it doesn't, well, that it doesn't converge weakly to something, which is a ground state. but he has some result in that direction. I think what, in talking to him, what I understand is that he knows that the overlap with the vacuum goes to zero, at least. I thought I would try to indicate some of the proofs. Can we all see this? Whoops. This is not going to work. Okay. And so I want to show you what... This is the simplest sort of result that you can imagine. What is the spectrum of H of Xi in the Maskless-Nelson model? So the first thing you think of is taking something that's close to the ground state, or there, maybe there isn't a ground state, but something that's close to, that has energy near the ground state energy, or the infimum of the spectrum, and adding a photon to that. But as we'll see, it doesn't really work very well. Let's see. Are there lights around here that I could turn off? We don't know that.
We can see it.
You can see it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not a problem.
Okay, forget about it, Alex. So the idea is to instead add two photons. You'll see why in a minute. Where the photon wave functions F1 and F2 are concentrated around a fixed momentum, non-zero momentum. One of them, let's say F1, is concentrated around K0, and the other one around minus K0. So we're not adding any total momentum, at least in some sort of limit when F1 and F2 get very concentrated around K0. And then the idea is to take a psi, which is converging to, well, which has energy in some very small neighborhood of E of Xi. Again, there's going to be a limit going on here. F1 and F2 are getting concentrated. Psi is getting energy closer and closer to E of Xi. And then show that this limit over here with the two photons added to the state psi has an energy 2 times absolute value K naught higher than E of Xi. And K naught is just arbitrary, except not zero, for this to work. And the vector that you're acting on will not be going to zero, so its norm will be bounded away from zero. So we need to do some calculations to see this. So when you take the HF and act on a photon creation operator, again, this is scalar photons and so on, it's not really photons. It's going to have more energy, absolute K more than what you started with, so you get that first relation right here, this one. Actually, it works for functions of the field energy as well. So instead of HF plus absolute K, you'll get G of HF plus absolute K. And that also works for the total momentum, PF. And so when you work out the commutation relation between H of C and A star of K, this is what you get. You get an addition of absolute K due to the first commutation relation with HF, and then the H of Xi minus K comes from the fact that PF occurs with a minus sign, so it's subtracting from Xi but adding to PF. And then you get the commutator of phi rho, that's phi rho of zero with A star of K, which is just a simple factor. So instead of really looking at just a fixed F1 and F2, we as I say, let F1 and F2 get more and more concentrated as they are down here, they will have L2 norm equal to 1. There's a fixed function F0. And as n goes to infinity, these get more and more concentrated around k equals k naught. We take F0 to have compact support around 0. And so F1 is concentrating around k naught, and F2n is concentrating around k minus k naught. And if you just do the commutation relations, you get this impressive looking formula over here. So all I really want to say here is, notice there's a k1 plus a k2 here. So they're sort of trying, because of this F1 and F2, they're kind of canceling out, because k1 wants to be equal to k0 and k2 equals minus k0. So they're sort of canceling out. This k1 and k2 are becoming this 2k0. Some interesting term is that extra commutator, which winds up looking like this. But the inner product of rho of k with, let's say, f1 n of k, let's see, how do I want to say this? So what you're getting here is you're getting a star of k2 times f2 n of k2 integrated. And then we have the inner product of rho of k1 with f1 k1. Now, actually, f1 of k1 is like the square root of a delta function. So when you integrate that product, it goes to 0. And so this term is negligible. And one has to work, of course, but that first term up there is also close to 0. You know, psi n has energy right around e of xi, so an h of xi is h of xi minus e of xi psi n is going to 0. Anyway, so you get something like that. Okay, so here we want to show the almost everywhere absence of a ground state for h of xi in this massless Nelson model. So you get, by commuting again, you get this equation. And if you look at the blue thing downstairs, which comes by taking the adjoint of the top one. Of course, this is all non-rigorous because it's there's a lot of work that has to be done. Because these distribution-valued operators have to be dealt with. So the idea here is to operate this on this ground state. So we assume there's a ground state with norm 1 here and try to show a contradiction. So the first term on the right is just equal to 0. And then we take the inverse of this operator operating on A of k. And we get something like this first formula that's written. Okay, so what about that first formula? Well, the idea is to first prove that it makes sense. Make some sort of sense. Like there's an inverse of some operator over there, maybe that should exist. Even for small k. Or even in the limit k goes to 0, it should, you know, with this factor of k there, it should be okay. On the other hand, so let's imagine that somehow the limit of this thing. Well, even if it doesn't have a limit, that thing is somehow non-zero in when k is very, very small, and can be handled. It doesn't go to zero. So if I take the inner product of the left-hand side and the right-hand side with a nice vector, I get the equation called star. So the nice vector is eta, and I've reversed the right-hand side and the left-hand side. So the idea is the right-hand side can be shown to be square integrable for small k if eta is in the domain of the square root of the number operator. In fact, the right-hand side in red, there's an inequality in red down here that tells you the inequality that's used. So notice that psi n plus 1 has an extra argument of k ready to be integrated over. But the left-hand side has a rho absolute squared divided by absolute k cubed, which is not integrable near zero. So one shows that the right-hand side is integrable, the left side is not. So that would be the contradiction. Okay, any questions? Okay, now it turns out that we can't integrate over all k, even in a ball around the origin, but we have to choose some cone. And here's where the differentiability of the energy comes in. So one first proves that it's Lipschitz, and therefore by Rademacher's theorem, the gradient exists almost everywhere. So let's take a point where the C such that the gradient actually exists. And then that thing that was in the denominator there, that operator we're taking the inverse of, is greater or equal to the energy at C minus K minus the energy at C plus this absolute value of K. And then because the energy is differentiable, if we take K in a plane in a half plane so that K dot grad E is non-negative, then we can say that this is a bigger than a half absolute K if absolute K is small. And so then that inverse of the operator makes sense. Now, what about the non-zero aspect of things? Well, here's the idea. Here's a simple application of the Schwarz inequality that says that the product of these two things is greater or equal to 1. There's a psi which should be there on the extreme right. So to show that this first factor is bounded from below by something, the second factor should be bounded from above. And one can just figure out what it is and see that it's bounded by something proportional to K, absolute K. So that implies that the quantity that we wanted to be non-zero has some chance of being non-zero. So then if we find an eta, which is close to psi, but is in the domain of n to the 1/2, n is a number operator, then we have this quantity being greater or equal to C0. And then our contradiction comes from the next inequality integrated over that half space intersected with a ball of small radius. Well, I have a, let's see, Unfortunately, the proof of the Pauli Fields, well, it's more complicated, although it needs an extra assumption, namely that the gradient of E at this point C is not equal to zero. So again, one proves that E is Lipschitz and that almost everywhere the gradient exists, therefore one has this Feynman-Helmholtz formula one can prove, which looks like this quantity C minus PF minus A rho expectation in the ground state. Let me not go through this whole thing over here, but just say that it's just a bit more complicated than what we saw in the for the massless Nelson model. And we need something that's non-zero, as we saw like in the massless Nelson, to work with. And we found that we needed to assume that the gradient was non-zero. This is actually, as I said, from Chen's work, it's actually known to be true if xi is small momentum, total momentum, and small coupling, but that's not very, you know, one would wish one had something better. So let me just quit there.